All right, good morning. You can find a seat. My name is Ryan. I'd like to thank you for coming out this morning. If you're hopping in for the first time or the first time in a while, you're actually coming in this morning to week three out of a series out of the book of Proverbs that we're calling The One Thing. Now, the point of this entire series, we're talking about the one thing that can actually make you better at everything, and that one thing is this thing called wisdom. This morning, we're actually starting a brand new section of this series, and so so it's a great week if you're hopping in for the first time, but what I wanted to do is just take a minute and kind of explain what we're doing here and what the flow of this series is going to be like. Our goal with this series was to put together the most helpful and the most useful teaching series that we ever have put together by addressing topics and areas of life and situations that we're all dealing with and want to get better at. And so really what we've done, this is a 14-week teaching series that's more like a collection of several different mini series. And so we're going to be in Proverbs talking about wisdom really from here until Easter Sunday. But what I wanted to do on the front end of this series in weeks one and two, which we finished last week, was first off talk about what wisdom is, and then in week two explain how we can grow in it and develop it and sort of build on it. But starting today and for the rest of the series, what we're gonna talk about is a number of topics that we're all dealing with, and I just wanted to explain how wisdom applies in all these different areas. So before we're through this series, we're going to talk about relationships. For several weeks, we're going to talk about personal development. We're going to talk about identifying and dealing with personal vices. We're going to talk about emotional health. We're going to talk about decision making and understanding God's will and how those two, our choices versus God's plan kind of relate to one another. Areas of life that I think we're all interested in. We all want to get better at. We all want to get better at, you know, relationships and personal development and making better decisions and stuff like that. But today, like I said, we're starting a new section of this series. And today we're going to be talking about something that we're all dealing with, whether we want to or not. It's this thing called work. So if you are new to the church, not terribly familiar with the teachings of the Bible, first off, it might really surprise you to hear that the Bible has anything to say about work. But it actually has a great deal to say about it, specifically in this book that we're in right now called Proverbs. If you read Proverbs through start to finish, it's amazing how many verses and how many sections are just dedicated to the topic of work. And the reason for that is because, among other things, work is a huge part of our lives. I mean, statistically speaking, you're going to spend at least one-third of your time alive at work, which is really wild to think about. And so if you're unwise when it comes to the area of work, what's going to happen is you're going to find yourself chronically dissatisfied and unfulfilled by your work. And if that's the case, then it's going to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to truly live a fulfilling life. And so this morning, what I wanted to do is just spend a few minutes talking about what it means to be wise in your work. And according to the book of Proverbs, to be wise in your work really requires three things. It requires that we have the right view of work. It requires that we have the right motives behind work. And then thirdly, it requires that we have the right goal of work. So with that, I just want to get right into the body of the talk today with our first main idea, which is this. It's that wisdom reshapes our view of work. So in Proverbs chapter 27, verse 18, we read this. It says, "Whoever tends a fig tree will eat its fruit, and whoever looks after his master will be honored." So I just want to focus on the second half of this proverb real briefly, because it's a deliberate paradox. When that proverb talks about looking after your master, that's talking about somebody who is a servant or a slave, somebody who's on the bottom rung of society, very low status. But what that proverb is saying that if you do that job well, then you'll actually be honored, which is a term that refers to high status. And so what we're seeing in this proverb, I think this is really important to understand when we talk about the topic of work, what we're seeing in this proverb is that in God's eyes, and maybe this will surprise you to hear this, but according to the Bible, in God's eyes, even the most seemingly menial or mundane tasks that maybe the rest of the world might look down on, in God's eyes, even those jobs have a certain value and worth and dignity to them. The book of Proverbs, and really you'll find this throughout the Bible as a whole, is incredibly, it has a very positive view of work. And it only becomes more clear when you compare what the Bible has to say with what other ancient religions and belief systems had to say. Because in almost every other ancient belief system or ancient culture or ancient civilization, what's clear is that almost every one of them viewed work through a very strictly negative lens. I mean, at its worst, work was believed to be a punishment that the gods gave us for our wrongdoing as humanity. But even through the best, most optimistic lenses, work was just kind of seen as a necessary evil, something that we got to do if we want to pay the bills and, you know, go about our lives the way that we want to. But when you consider that and you look at what the Bible has to say about work, what you'll find is that the teaching of the Bible is remarkably positive. Because all the way at the beginning of the Bible, literally, in just the second chapter of the very first book, Genesis, what we see is this picture of God with his hands in the dirt. Now, that would have been really shocking to ancient cultures, specifically in Rome and Greece, because that was manual labor. That was really looked down on. But what you see in just the second chapter of the Bible is that God did not consider manual labor beneath him, because there he was with his hands in the dirt actually creating us. And just a few verses later, we see that God created paradise, which paradise obviously was the ideal environment for human flourishing. But even before sin broke that environment, even before sin began to wreak havoc on the good world that God had made, even in paradise, work was still a part of our design, because God actually made people in paradise to be gardeners and charged them with the work of tending to and caring for that garden. Now, because the Bible shows that work was a part of our design by God even before sin made a mess of everything, that means at least two things for us that we really have to be careful to keep in mind when we think about or when we talk about the idea of work. What this means, first and foremost, is that all work has an intrinsic, unalienable kind of dignity and value and worth to it. But what this also means for you and I personally is that based on what we see in Scripture, if you are not working at all, or if you are doing something that you do not believe in at all, what that means is it's going to significantly negatively impact your life. You're going to experience a kind of disorientation, because you're actually living in a way that's really against the grain of your design by God. And I heard one pastor say it this way: you're going to experience an atrophy of your soul. And the reason for that is because work is not a necessary evil that we just have to get through. Work is actually a part of the original design for our lives by God. So first and foremost, wisdom should reshape the way that we view work itself. But according to Proverbs, that's not enough. It's not enough to just have the correct view of work. Secondly, and this is going to be our next main idea this morning, wisdom reshapes our motives behind our work. One thing that I talked to both the 8:30 and the 10 a.m. services about is Proverbs. I think one helpful way to think about the book is that it's not necessarily always the book that we want, but it is the book that we need. And what I mean by that is, I think everybody would love it, you know, a book like Proverbs that's all about teaching us wisdom and what it means to make wise choices. I think everybody would love it if there was a chapter somewhere in Proverbs that was about jobs, and on the left-hand side it said these are the unwise jobs, and on the right-hand side it says these are the wise jobs. So, you know, take out the guesswork. Take out the gray area, the ambiguity. Just do with that whatever you want. But don't blame anybody when you pick an unwise job. But Proverbs doesn't give us that kind of instruction. What Proverbs does, instead of talking about any job that's wise or unwise in and of itself, what Proverbs is going to help us understand is what the right motives are for choosing any kind of job at all. And in Proverbs, there's two motives that we're told need to motivate us and drive us and really fuel us behind our work that I want to walk through real quickly. The first motive is this: we need to work in response to human community. All right, in Proverbs chapter 10, verse 5, we read this. You know, I would just keep my glasses off the entire time, but I literally can't see that without glasses. My eyesight a doctor told me this has nothing to do with the teaching. This is not an illustration. I'm just opening up to you guys. It's been a long day, all right? If my vision goes from up close, I will be legally blind. So I don't have any idea what you should do about that, but now we're in this together. All right, Proverbs chapter 10, verse 5 says, "The son who gathers during summer is prudent. The son who sleeps during harvest is disgraceful." All right, a small detail, but a really important one, is this word son. All right, that proverb does not say a person who gathers during summer is prudent, or an employee, or a worker, or a man. It just says a son. The reason for that is because what this proverb is teaching us, and I think this is so misunderstood in our society, this is probably going to sound really weird to you, what this proverb is showing is that a failure in your work is actually a failure in your family. That when you fail at work, it's not just a personal thing, you're failing the people around you, because work, according to God's design and according to God's word, is actually for the community. And when this says that a son who sleeps during harvest is disgraceful, a lot of times people try... They associate disgrace, the concept of disgrace and guilt, and kind of talk about them like they're interchangeable, but they're not. Guilt is failing to live up to a standard, whereas disgrace is a failure of community. To live in disgrace means that you have failed to do what you ought to do for the people around you. So just pulling out the principle from this proverb, what this means is that you and I should choose our work, and we should do our work more so for the people around us than we do for simply profit and personal advancement. And I don't have to tell you, that is as bizarre an idea as you're going to hear in our culture. Because it goes, I mean, most people, it's not even something that you think about, it's just, it's like a fish swimming in water. You know, you've been conditioned this to think this way your whole life. In our culture, it's a given. Nobody needs to say this out loud, but you choose a career path primarily, if not entirely, for how that career path is going to benefit you personally. We just don't think about work in terms of how it's going to impact other people or what that's going to do for the community to raise the quality of life for people around me. There was a British essayist named Dorothy Sayers who spoke to this. I thought this was really helpful. Here's what she had to say. She said, "The habit of thinking about work as something one does to make money is so ingrained in us that we can scarcely imagine what a revolutionary change it would be psychologically and socially to think otherwise. In the modern view, people become doctors not primarily to relieve suffering, but to bring themselves and their family up in the world. People become lawyers not because they have a passion for justice, but to bring themselves and their family up in the world." Just as a caveat here, let me save myself the angry email. That's not a shot against doctors or lawyers. I have friends who are doctors or lawyers. She's just speaking about the motives that drive the decisions people make in the work world. She wrote in and around the time of World War II, and in reflecting on that, she said this. She said, "After World War II, one of the great surprises for many Englishmen who had to serve in the army was that they found themselves for the very first time in their entire lives happy and satisfied." Why? She said, "Because for the first time in their lives, they found themselves doing something not for the pay or the status, but for the sake of getting something done for us all." When Sayers wrote that it would be a social revolution if we approached work more on the basis of how that will impact and benefit others, what she was saying is, and I would just ask you to take a second here and really consider what this kind of world would be like to live in. Imagine if everybody in a given culture, in a given society, or in your city or neighborhood or whatever it is, imagine if the first thought in everybody's mind when getting into the work world was, what do people need and how can I improve the quality of their life through my work? You imagine what that would be like? It'd be a Disney movie. Every day of your life, just be incredible. It'd be like that. Every single one of us would benefit in tangible and intangible ways because of that. It would be a social revolution. But more than that, Sayers said that it would be a psychological revolution. I mean, not only would it be good for society in general, it would be good for you and I personally. Because what happens, and this is a promise all throughout Scripture, is that when we begin to do things more for the people around us than for ourselves, it's then and only then, kind of ironically, that we begin to experience the meaning, the purpose, the satisfaction, and the fulfillment that we're always going to be robbed of if we go through life in a primarily self-centered way. So the first motive, Proverbs says, should really guide you as you go to work or as you choose work, is you should work in response to human community. But even that isn't enough by itself. So the second motive is, in addition to working in response to human community, secondly, you have to work in response to God's unique calling on your life. All right, in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 29, it says, "Do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand in the presence of kings. He will not stand in the presence of unknown men." Now, that word skilled is a Hebrew word. It simply refers to a man or a woman that has a talent, an ability, or what we would call a gift. And so the principle in that proverb is when you're considering what line of work you're going to enter into, or what field of work you want to study, or what career you want to invest one-third of the time you're going to be alive in, what you should do is you should look into yourself and ask yourself not just what is responsible according to somebody else's standard, or what do other people expect me to do, but what am I uniquely interested in and passionate about, and what has God given me a natural affinity and talent and ability and gift for. And when we put these two ideas together and we begin doing our work for the people around us and we begin doing work that God has gifted us in naturally, what will happen according to Proverbs is we'll begin to experience just a depth of meaning and purpose that so many people in the workforce today across the world never experience because they cut across the grain of those two ideas. So the second idea this morning is that wisdom should reshape our motives behind work. But thirdly, and this is going to be our last idea this morning, wisdom reshapes the goal of work itself. So I want to spend some time on this one. Everybody loves to hear a pastor say that, right? Just two and a half hours tops, we'll be out of here. So Proverbs 8, verses 1 through 3 says, "Doesn't wisdom call out? Doesn't understanding make her voice heard? At the heights overlooking the road, at the crossroads, she takes her stand. Beside the gates, at the entry to the city, at the main entrance, she cries out." If you were here for week one of this series, I mentioned that so many times in Proverbs, the concept of wisdom is personified, meaning wisdom is spoken of as a person. And that's what you're seeing here in Proverbs 8. And so what you're seeing is wisdom refuses to stay in the home, but instead goes out into public life and calls out and sort of demands that her voice be heard. And there's three areas that wisdom does this. First, it says, beside the gates. Right, in ancient cities, the gates were where the elders would sit and decide cases. So for instance, if you felt like somebody wronged you, then you would drag that person to the gates where the elders would kind of decide who's right and who's wrong and who needs to pay what in order to remedy the situation. It was the ancient version of the judicial system. And so what you're reading there is wisdom demands to have a voice in the judicial system. God cares about justice. And people are going to, it's the best case scenario for people's lives if God's wisdom has a voice and really impacts the judicial system, the justice system. The second thing we see there is that wisdom is calling out at this place called the crossroads. Now, the crossroads in cities are simply where paths cross, literally crossroads, and it's where squares are formed. In more modern cities, if you think about New York City, the crossroads where the squares are formed, that's Times Square, that's Union Square. And so even in ancient cities, that's where, you know, there's going to be a lot of foot traffic, which means that's where markets are going to pop up. People are going to be buying and selling and trading and all that kind of stuff. And so for wisdom to call out there means that wisdom demands to have a voice, to have a say in the commercial realm. But the last place, according to these verses, that wisdom calls out is something that I think maybe we don't understand as much, and this is what I actually wanted to camp out on. It says that wisdom calls out at the heights. In ancient cities, the things of greatest value were in the highest places, and I mean that literally. If you just walked through ancient cities, if like not even in a figurative sense, in a literal sense, the highest part of those cities geographically, the mounts, you know, the mountains, the high ground, is where they would put their temples. And that's where you could find out what that city or what that culture really valued, what they really worshiped, what they really considered most important. And so if you wanted to know what any given society or culture held most dear, you just look up at the heights. And that's going to tell you all that you need to know. And it's really, actually, no different today in our culture. Because if you go to any major city in the United States today, the tallest buildings are still telling the story of what our culture says is the most important thing in life. And in our major cities, you see where I'm going with this, but in our major cities, the tallest buildings are no longer church steeples. They were at one time, they're not anymore. The tallest buildings are not educational facilities. The tallest buildings are not nonprofit organizations dedicated to helping the poor and all that kind of stuff. The tallest buildings, unequivocally, in every major city are office buildings. And that, more than anything else, tells us what our culture says is most important in our world. And according to our culture, what it's all about, it's not about family. It's not about divine authority. It's not about, you know, being willing to personally sacrifice for the good of people around you. In our culture, it's all about one thing and one thing only, and that's personal fulfillment, period. In our culture, we're almost unconditionally sort of indoctrinated with this belief that the purpose of life is to work as hard as you can, to make as much money as you can, to have the best life that you can for yourself, regardless of what you need to do and who you need to step on in order to have that life, personal fulfillment. Now, with that in mind, in Proverbs chapter 8, what it means that wisdom calls out on the heights, what that's saying is that God's wisdom demands to set the tone for what's most important. And what this means for us personally is that if we want to be wise, if we have any desire to be wise at all, then we have to let the goal of our work, the things that we're working for, the purpose for which we go to work, the things that we consider most valuable, that thing that we've told ourselves is the greatest thing in life that's going to make life worth living. What this means is that we have to let the goal of our work be reshaped by God's wisdom, by what God says is most important, by what God says is most meaningful, by what God says this life is really all about. And if you do that, you know, I don't think this is going to come as a shock to you, what that's going to cause you to do, it's going to cause you to make decisions that frequently leave the people around you scratching their head, because it's going to go completely against the grain of what culture says life is really all about. All right? Now, maybe you're wondering what that would actually look like in your life, and I have a perfect story to show exactly what it looks like when people who have been impacted by what God has done for them decide to live that out in the public sphere. In the 1700s in Britain, there was a great awakening where hundreds of thousands of people came to the saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. They heard this idea called the gospel, that God loved them so much that Jesus came down here to live the perfect life for them, to die for their sins on the cross and rise again for them. They responded to that. It had to, you know, transform their life. And so then they started asking the question, well, what would it look like for me to live my faith out in public life? What would it look like if my faith was more than just a private thing that stayed in the home? What they were really asking is, what would it look like if we allowed God's wisdom to call out on the heights and set the tone for society? And these weren't pastors, these weren't preachers, these were just ordinary people that had come to know Jesus and wanted to live a life that reflected that. So they started looking around their culture in the late 1700s, early 1800s in Britain, and it caused them to see the world differently. And what they couldn't ignore anymore, the reality that was right in front of them every day in their culture, was the African slave trade. So for 30 years in Britain, Christians did everything that they could to try to put an end to slavery, to emancipate slaves and to abolish the slave trade altogether. And at one point, Christians in Britain actually, they did a petition drive. They got one half of the voting population to vote to end it, but the people at the top, with the money and therefore the power, didn't like that, and they were against it because they knew that abolishing slavery would basically cause all kinds of negative repercussions throughout the economy for the entire country. And I want to read you a quote about this. It says, "The planters in the colonies warned that emancipation would cost investors in Britain catastrophic losses and pointed out that everyone in Britain would pay because the price of sugar and the price of many other foodstuffs would rise greatly if it had to be produced by free labor. These appeals carried weight in the House of Lords. In those days, the Lords were not a figurehead, and the moneyed class stood to lose even more mightily than everyone else, and their agreement was needed for all legislation." So the abolitionists who wanted to see slavery get put in the rear view knew what they had to do. If this abolition act stood any chance of passing, they knew that they were going to have to basically pay off the people who already had the most money and the most power to compensate them for their losses in order to get this thing through. So they made a decision. Abolitionists in Britain in the early 1800s made a decision that was so mind-boggling, it caused historians and scholars, it just baffled them. It caused them to just not understand what was going on and try to figure it out decades after they did. What they did in the early 1800s in Britain, in order to appease these people at the top and to compensate them so that this bill could get through, they agreed to take an amount of money out of their own nation's treasury, the British National Treasury. They took an amount of money out of their own treasury, equal to one half of the nation's annual budget. And they threw that at these people to compensate for their losses, and it worked. And in 1833, the Abolition Act passed. And like everybody predicted, it basically destroyed the economy. Individual taxes, the price of foodstuffs, and the cost of living skyrocketed for people to the point that one historian, reflecting on what the abolitionists did there, actually called it voluntary econocide. All right, now that decision really bothered, like I said, scholars and historians for a number of reasons, but primarily because that act just didn't make sense with what they normally saw is the case in human behavior, specifically in the political realm. To a group of people, I mean thousands and thousands and thousands of people, to make a decision like that, that would greatly cost them and benefit people that to a large part they had never even really met before, they could not wrap their mind around that. People were speculating about, is there an ulterior motive? Is there a new angle to look at this from? And finally, a historian named Howard Temperley spoke to this, and he settled it once and for all. Here's what he said. The British anti-slavery movement has continued to intrigue historians, not the least because of the apparent lack of self-interest on the part of its principal supporters. This is totally contrary to conventional views of political behavior, and it's given rise to much scholarly controversy. Yet, in spite of the exercise of much ingenuity over the last 30 years, no one has succeeded in showing that those who campaigned for the end of the slave trade and for the freeing of the slaves stood to personally gain in any way, but rather only to lose. And he bottom lined it with this statement. He said, "The fact is, those who brought about abolition in Britain did two things. They quoted the Bible, and they talked about sin and God's saving grace." That's what it looks like when God's people allow God's wisdom to call out on the high places of their lives on any kind of scale. When I was putting this teaching together about work, which admittedly I haven't really taught a lot on, I do this with every teaching, but it really caused me to think with this one. I started thinking about all the individual people that I thought were probably going to show up on Sunday to hear this. And I try to personalize my teachings as much as possible because, like I said on the front end here, I hope you know I'm not blowing smoke. I really want these teachings to be helpful to you, to be useful to you, to tell you what God expects and give you all the tools that you need to do it. That's why I do this. I take it, you know, really seriously. I hope it comes across that way. So I started thinking about all the people that were going to show up across three services on a Sunday morning. And one of the things that really struck me is how diverse our church is when it comes to the work world. Because if you're new here, we are a very multi-generational church, which is a rare thing. Like in any one of our Next Steps classes, which we're having one here pretty soon, we'll see people from the, you know, age 18, 19 years old to, you know, 78, 79, 85 years old. It's not an uncommon thing. And on Sunday morning, you see that manifested. You can look around you right now and probably see that. And so what that means is on any given Sunday, there's people that are just getting started in the work world. There's people that have retired from their official jobs. There's people that have really climbed the ranks in their career. There's people that are just getting their feet wet. We got, you know, small business owners and entrepreneurs. And I say that to say that this concept of allowing God's wisdom to reshape the goal of your work, that's going to look wildly different for you than it is for all the people around you. Right? Of course, if you're a government contractor with 35 years of experience and you've climbed the ranks and you got all these teams reporting to you, yeah, this idea is going to apply much differently to you than if you're working a part-time job between semesters to pay for college. It's going to look different. But here's what it will always have in common when God's people allow God's wisdom to reshape the goal of their work. Here's what it's always going to translate to. We will make personal sacrifices for the sake of the people around us. That's what it always looks like. When Howard Temperley talked about those abolitionists in Britain in the early 1800s, he said nobody could make a strong case that these people stood to gain anything from what they did, but rather only to lose. That's what it looks like when we allow God's wisdom to reshape the goal of our work. Now, before I step down here today, and I'm almost done, one thing that I felt like I have to acknowledge is how naive and idealistic this whole thing sounds. What I mean by that is if we had never had a job before, then this sounds really inspiring. You know, this idea that all work is valuable in God's eyes And, you know, if we just approach it with the right goals and motives, we can make a difference. That sounds great, but it's almost nobody's experience on a Monday morning. I actually saw a study one time that revealed that the saddest hour for Americans all week is Sunday at noon. And there's one reason. It's because Monday is coming, and we can no longer deny it. Like a freight train, right? You're going to have to clock in again. So most people don't have butterflies in their stomach thinking about clocking into work on Monday morning because as well as I do, I think you start off life really idealistic and hopeful about work. But by the end, it's really tough to not get callous and cynical about it because work is frustrating and it can kind of wear you out and grind you down and have you to the point where, you know, you're clocking in wondering, you know, you've just lost the hope that anything that you're doing is ever going to matter in any way for anyone. And it can just kind of turn you into a zombie that you just clock in and you clock out and you wait for retirement. And that is so not the life that we are built for. And it's so not God's Father's heart for us. He doesn't want us to go through life like that. So what's the answer to that? And that's the last thing that I want to speak to today. This is going to be the last proverb I read. It's Proverbs chapter 15, verse 19. It says that a slacker's way is like a thorny hedge, but the path of the upright is a highway. Now, like most proverbs, at first glance, it looks really straightforward. What that's basically saying is if you're lazy, life's going to be difficult. If you're diligent, it won't. But that doesn't say diligent. It says upright. The path of the upright is a highway. Or, you know, put differently, the path of the righteous is a highway. That's a real problem for us. Because Psalm 130 says that if God kept a record of sins, nobody, none of us are left standing. So what does that proverb actually mean, that only the path of the upright is a highway and everybody else has this thorny hedge? Well, that word thorns in this proverb is so significant because it points back to something that God said in the very beginning of the Bible when sin broke the world. In Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 and 18, God is explaining to Adam and Eve what their decision to turn their back on him would do. And here's what he said. He said, "Cursed is the ground because of you. You will eat from it by means of painful labor all the days of your life, and it will produce thorns and thistles for you." And what God is explaining in those verses is that one of the effects of sin would be in the area of work, that now our work would be incredibly painful, it would be frustrating, it would be filled with disappointments, and it would always produce thorns again and again and again. And I know that you felt that before, this idea that it doesn't ever work out exactly the way that you want to, and for those momentary periods of time that it does, they just don't seem to last. All of that, according to God, is the result of the curse of sin. But then you get to the New Testament, and you can read in Galatians chapter 3 that Jesus, the Son of God, came down here to redeem us from that curse by actually becoming a curse for us. And just like the curse that we brought on ourselves came with thorns, so Jesus, when he took on our curse for us, it brought him thorns. Because hours before Jesus went to the cross, the Bible says that Roman soldiers knelt before him and mocked him by placing a crown on his head that was actually made of thorns, which is incredibly symbolic and incredibly significant. And what we see at the cross is Jesus going through the most painful, the most devastating work imaginable for us, which was paying for our sins so that we could come home to God. That's what the cross shows us. And 3 days later, what we see in the resurrection, what we have the hope of, that just as Jesus has risen from the grave, what that means is that one day that this world is going to work the way that it was originally supposed to, that one day the curse is going to be lifted, that one day the thorns are going to be gone forever and our work will no longer be frustrating and disappointing like it is now. One day that will be a faint memory. And what happens when the reality of what Jesus has done for us, living for us, dying for us, rising again for us, when that dawns on us, what it does is it allows us and it really gives us the energy and the ability to approach our work in a way that honors God without losing hope. Because as the gospel becomes real to us, what it does is it creates this unique balance in every area of our life, but specifically in work, because it keeps us from being overly idealistic about our jobs, but it also keeps us from being pessimistic about our jobs. You know, on the one hand, if you know what Jesus has done for you, then you're not going to clock in Monday through Friday and just be working yourself to death, trying to, you know, prove yourself through career success, because you're going to be able to rest in what Jesus has done for you. But on the other hand, knowing what Jesus has done for you is also going to, it should really produce in you a seriousness about your work, because you're going to realize that your job is nothing more than an opportunity to do for somebody else what God has done for you through Jesus. But overall, what will happen is that we'll approach our work with the hope that comes from knowing that one day Jesus is going to set this whole thing right. And as that becomes more real to us, our view of work changes, our motives for work changes, and our goals for work changes. And that's really what it means to be wise in your work. Next week, we're going to talk about what it means to be wise with your money. I'm anticipating that's going to be a lively discussion. So be here and bring somebody you care about. All right, that's it. That's all.